from the WGN Skyline
Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for October the 20th, 2019. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. And I have to tell you, it's pretty darn nice out there. This is very temperate right now.
It is. A mild day and really looking into the week, Rick.
Other than tomorrow.
Pretty mild day. Days coming ahead in the mid-50s for highs. Nothing terribly cold as yet, although
we are
getting into late October, Halloween next week. But looking at the basic forecast here from Tom Skilling, periods of sun. Some showers, off and on, but temperatures, tomorrow in the 60s, but staying pretty much in the mid-50s through the rest of the week, so it'll be fairly nice.
Yeah, no, very comfortable.
We got a taste, though, of some colder weather being up in northern Michigan here earlier in the week. Needed some extra layers, especially walking around out at Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. But beautiful fall color. Just gorgeous.
A little frost up there?
Didn't see any frost. No, it was hovering around, let's see, we were in the 40s.
Oh.
So it wasn't terribly, terribly cool, but the wind was the one. Yes, is always the case, wind and cooler temperatures, and being close to the lake, why, you're going to feel it. But such as some gorgeous fall color.
Oh, it's beautiful country.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Just wherever you look, it's just gorgeous up there.
We were disappointed, as I was telling you earlier, about this one drive, hiking area and driving area through Sleeping Bear called the Pierce Stocking Drive.
Right.
Which can be stunningly beautiful. Sadly, it was closed because of the high winds were blowing down some trees. So they had branches and things in the road, which they had to clear, and they didn't want anybody getting hurt. So we weren't able to take that drive.
And no shortage of trees along that ride either.
No shortage of trees is right. So that just means we'll have to go back.
Well, you don't need an excuse to go back there.
No, I'm just saying I'm going.
it's although you didn't climb the dunes.
No, not this time. And I'll tell you, you would have needed some heavy duty warm weather gear to climb that with that wind and the stress of climbing it. You're not only facing an uphill climb on a sand dune,
right.
So you take a half step back for
that's
every
the
step
thing.
You
yes,
take.
For every step you take, you slide down half.
But you would be walking just head on into that wind, which could be fierce.
Oh.
So we just looked at the dune from the parking lot
from afar.
Right.
Yes, yes. Oh, look up there. Yeah. But it once you're up there, though, it is
what a
stunning.
View. Yeah,
oh.
Yeah. It's a spectacular vista. It really is. You can lose sight of the fact that you're in the Midwest because, you have this notion that everything is just flat here. Not everywhere.
Oh, the terrain. Yeah, it's just gorgeous. Just, as I said, everywhere you look, it's just gorgeous.
It really is. Yeah.
But you didn't bring me any goodies.
I regret that, and I didn't get. I always like to get you a local newspaper from some of the towns that we were in. But we were staying with friends and on the go, and weren't able to pick up any goodies.
So. Although you mentioned this one thing, you can the whitefish dip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that sounds.
Yeah, there's a
Ritz crackers and whitefish dip.
There's a local store, or a couple of them up there, locally owned, that have been there for a long time, called Tosky Sands. Kind of a combination of Petoskey and the sands, meaning the dunes up there. But their specialty is a homemade local recipe whitefish dip that you would put on crackers and spreads and so forth, and was recommended to us by some friends up there.
Now, see, that sounds like a good football snack.
Perfect football, yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. Speaking of which, we do have a little football this afternoon.
Yes, we do. Bears,
just a little, yeah.
Bears-Saints at the afternoon game.
Yeah, they're at 3:25.
Do they have any more noon games left?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because, let's see, first game,
next week
7:30.
Is a noon game, isn't it?
Next week was 3:25. The
next
following week was 7:15. The next week was 3:25. Then they were at noon against the Raiders. So the next time will be on a noon will be against the Chargers a week from today.
Ah, okay.
And then three in a row, believe that or not.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Three new games in a row.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Novel concept.
Now, what are we expecting today?
You know, it'll be interesting. We were talking on the morning show to Dan Hampton the other day, and he's not expecting much offense in this game to the point where the score may be pretty low, 13-10-ish. The Bears' offense has been pathetic, to say the least, and New Orleans operating with a backup quarterback, Teddy Bridgewater. Again, today, no Drew Brees and no Alvin Kamara. They're all-purpose running back. So you would think that this would line up very nicely for the Bears' defense, although the Bears' defense didn't perform up to what they thought they could against the Raiders up in London, or
yeah,
over in London, I should say.
And I mean, I really want to see the defense break through, because that is the bread and butter here.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch today, too, because Akeem Hicks goes on the injured reserve. Again, that doesn't mean the season's over. He could return, but it will be a few weeks before he can be able to do that. But when he left the game against the Raiders, they designed a scheme where they didn't have to worry about him, obviously, because he wasn't in the game. And you didn't hear Khalil Mack's name mentioned quite a bit in that second half of that game because they were double-teaming him the entire time.
And triple-teaming.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see who steps up on that interior of the defensive line today. Bilal Nichols is ready to go, but apparently today he's still listed as questionable with the hand injury. But from what we're hearing, and with all the reports during the week, that he may play with a big rap on that hand and at least be a threat to get to the quarterback.
I'm looking forward to it. I absolutely. And I'm looking forward to the Blackhawks tonight against the Caps.
Yeah, the Blackhawks have done some nice things the last three games. I was at the game Friday, the overtime winner against Columbus. Nice to see the captain get on the board for the first time this
even
year.
Even though it went off his knee.
Yeah, he said it went off his shin pads, but he was not going to steal any thunder from Andrew Shaw's famous shin pads chant back in 2013.
Right.
So that didn't bother him at all. But it was nice to see, they fought back a couple of times to quell the tide, so to speak, of Columbus. Pretty good little team, Columbus.
Yes, they are.
I'll tell you, they're fast.
Are.
They skate real well. But the Hawks played very nicely in that game as well. And I got my Marian Hossa bobblehead, which was nice. And, of course, tonight's bobblehead,
yes,
is a little more special.
This is real special, real special.
Yeah, it is the John and Troy bobblehead tonight. And who better to get a bobblehead than those two guys, right? I mean, they do such a tremendous job here for us at WGN and also for the Blackhawks. They're fun to listen to. I got a chance to see those guys a little bit before the game the other night as well, and two classy guys, and Chris Bowden fills out that trio very nicely.
No, it's a great team, and I have to say I love Troy's comment about the how he looks on the bobblehead. It's it's hard to mess up a bald guy.
Yeah, leave that to him for the self-deprecation, of course. But
But as he said, hey, when you get a bobblehead, you've made it.
That's the truth,
and it is.
It's the absolute truth. Yeah, those guys are a popular pair. I mean, I know that the guys on TV get a lot of play because folks will watch the game. But if you haven't listened to a game lately here on WGN Radio, you should, because they have a blast. And John Weideman is one of the best in the business, if not the best.
Bob the Engineer just brought one in of the bobblehead.
Nice.
John and Troy. This thing is classic. It is. That's just gorgeous.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
It absolutely is. And truly, as you said, yeah, the TV guys, they get the attention,
mm-hmm,
but you need to listen. And I, obviously I grew up back in the day where you didn't get to see the Blackhawks on TV.
Me too.
And, it was Lloyd Pettit.
Yes, it was.
That's how I'd go to sleep at night with the transistor radio, listening to Lloyd Pettit calling Bobby Hull and Stan Mikita and all of those guys back in the day.
Yeah. He always amazed me with listening to Lloyd do those games.
Shot and a goal.
A shot and a goal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's just, I mean, I still, here come the Hawks. How old is that jingle? And it still reminds me of all of the great history of that team.
It's funny you say that because I was playing the song the other day, and my girlfriend wanted to hear it because she hadn't heard it the way it really was. And I had to give the trivia question about who wrote it because it's a Chicago connection to a pop singer of the 80s, Richard Marx, dad, Dick Marx, and his orchestra were the guys that did that. And I remember, Rick, when the Hawks would come out on the ice for the first time at the stadium, that would blare through the public address system. And that was something that raised the hair on my arms even when I was playing it for her.
It's the glory days at the old Madhouse. I mean, it's still... it was time probably in retrospect to replace the old barn, but I remember the final season kind of logo was Remember the Roar.
Right, Remember the Roar.
And there was nothing like the place because you'd swear it could fall down any minute.
The most precarious places there were the second balcony, because you could get a seat in the second balcony of the old stadium where you were actually looking down above the scoreboard.
Yes.
And trying to decipher who it was out there on the ice. But you know what? You didn't care because you were there and it was loud and it was great.
And that's when you were also trying to decipher grandfather clock scoreboard.
with the arms that moved.
With the rings.
Yeah, the little dials.
Yes. Which apparently worked to great success, because, of course, the Hawks had that scoreboard well into the digital age.
Yeah.
But apparently it worked as a great device for opposing teams because they were never really sure when a guy was in the penalty box how much time was left on the penalty.
Right.
Until the hands went to the right spot.
Yeah.
Or the guy opened the door in the penalty box to let the guy out.
And then there was Harvey Wittenberg, of course, saying, yes. 1 minute to play in the period.
1 minute to play in the period.
Exactly.
Harvey's great, that great monotone he had.
Harvey's a great guy, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Great times.
Good memories.
But
some new memories.
Let's create, yes. Yeah, we've got plenty of new memories.
Absolutely right.
Kirby Doc?
Yeah, that's going to be fun if he gets out there tonight.
I got to think.
Yeah, it's he's done with his rehab assignment, so to speak, with Rockford. He's back on the active roster now. And it would be really cool to watch an 18-year-old guy make his NHL debut. I'm not going to put any pressure on him to score a goal in his first game, but, it would be certainly nice to see.
All eyes will be watching.
I agree.
That's for sure.
I definitely agree.
We got a third rounder, and who was that? Who was the great third rounder after choice that we had?
Oh, what's his name again?
Yeah, I think he's got a C on his sweater.
He does, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Taves.
Yep, the number 3 overall pick.
So, good luck, Kirby, and we're all looking for good things from you as maybe we start a new era here in Chicago.
That'd be fun.
It'd be great. I could see a couple more Stanley Cups in the future.
Maybe he'll get a bobblehead.
He's got to earn it.
Yes, he
does. He's got to earn it.
Yes,
come
he does.
Come on. Come on. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy, of course, is here with the latest sports. Producer Cassera is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all smashed together there. And we're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is starting to dig out last year's leftover Halloween candy. Well, remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio. And joining me here in the studio is the John Wiedemann and Troy Murray bobblehead. And if you go to WGNRadio.com, you can see the various studio cameras and you'll be able to see the bobblehead, which is, it's really classic. Now I got to figure out a way to go to the game tonight and be one of the first 10,000 people to get there. But well-deserved honor by those guys. Starting a little spin through the national politics, and you've heard Dave report on this during the newscast, but that the president, under tons of criticism, including by Republicans, ethics watchdogs, Democrats, of course, the president tweeted out late Saturday that he would no longer host next year's Group of Seven, the G7 summit at his Doral resort. And that reversal, rare from the president, came 2 days after the White House said that the decision had already been made and was all set. So Trump acknowledges he's going to look for someplace new. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Interesting week in Washington, of course. We had the fallout of the president's decision to allow Turkey to basically invade northern Syria, sending Vice President Pence over to talk to Erdogan in Turkey. There was a announced ceasefire, which turned into more like a pause, according to the Turks, the success of which is still in doubt because of sporadic fighting going on. There was a meeting in the Oval Office on Wednesday with the president and congressional leaders. Didn't go very well. Democrats walked out after the president began name-calling. Here's how Nancy Pelosi described it to reporters.
We witnessed on the part of the president was a meltdown. Sad to say.
Speaker Pelosi, did we approach you with the
interview? No, it didn't come up. It did not come up. Not at all. No, it did not come up. It did not come up.
But he called you a communist? Can you just...
No, he didn't call... No, he did not call us a communist. He said you... Yeah.
He said, let's just clarify that. He said the communists are taking over.
Some of ISIS were communists,
and you would be happy.
That might make you happy.
That might make you happy.
And the speaker said, yes, we walked out.
Yeah. At that point?
When he started calling Speaker Pelosi a third-rate politician.
Which I said, I wish you were a politician, Mr. President, then you would know the art of the possible.
The art of the possible. We'll see what happens as the week unfolds, now particularly after this G7 decision. Well, we're going to bring things local now, and joining me on the phone is Melissa Conyers-Irvin. She is the city treasurer for the city of Chicago. Madam Treasurer, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to have you on for a couple of reasons, and obviously we're at interesting times in this city. We have the teacher strike going on. We're awaiting the mayor's budget message. The financial issues basically confronting the city are somewhat staggering. And I know that you, in your campaign as well as in your administration, you've been looking for ways to kind of help drive economic improvement in some of the city's poor neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that have been overlooked, while everybody looks at downtown as kind of the growth of the city. And I know that you're looking at this issue of the Catalyst Fund. What is, maybe you could explain the Catalyst Fund and what that's aimed to do.
Yes. The Catalyst Fund was initiated by my predecessor as well as Mayor Lifer's predecessor. And we, many people heard about it. It was called 77 Neighborhoods. People call it the Catalyst Fund. But it is a fund that was funded by the city of Chicago with $100 million. And it was really designed to jumpstart communities, especially underserved communities, and ways to help small businesses. So actually this past Friday, my staff and I, we had a meeting on the west side of Chicago at the Hatchery in East Garfield Park. And we met with five small business owners to really talk about how the Catalyst Fund can help jumpstart their business and other small businesses in underserved communities. And really, Rick, when you look at communities, if you show me a community that has thriving small businesses, you can show me a thriving community. And that's really what it's all about. We all know that small businesses really help the community in several ways. typically these are people that live in the community or people that live in a neighboring community. And when they have a small business, we have seen that those investments return directly back into the community. And we need people that are vested in our community. When we were talking to one of the business owners, she had mentioned that she hires young people to work at her business during the summer. And I was just at awe when she told me that her being a small business owner, she actually provides a scholarship to one of the children. It may even be one or two of the children that she provides scholarships to that work with her over the summer. That is amazing, and that is exactly what our communities need.
Well, and the thing about small business is that the customer base tends to be local, the employment base tends to be local, the ownership yes. is local, and it's kind of the churning of the money to help build up that local economy.
Yes, and Rick, what I really appreciate about the Catalyst Fund, which makes sense that me as the treasurer would be the chairman of the board of directors for the Catalyst Fund, because the Catalyst Fund is a little bit different than what we're used to as far as funding in Chicago. Most programs we hear about in Chicago are really grants, programs that are provided to residents or businesses. But the Catalyst Fund is unique in that I call it a win-win. Number one, we're helping small businesses that are turning around and helping our communities. So that is a win. But number two, we are actually investing in a company, not necessarily providing a grant. So we're investing with an expected rate of return, which makes sense that the treasurer will be chairman of the board in an instance such as this.
When you say rate of return, so does that mean money flows back into the fund?
Exactly. That is the intent of the Catalyst Fund. It is to invest. So the city of Chicago would be one of the investors in a company. That means that we are looking for that investment to return to us.
So almost like an incubator kind of thing.
Very similar to programs you hear about with Axion, LISC, which are two partners that were also at the hatchery with us at that meeting this past Friday.
So what is the status of this program?
So the status of the program is that it was created by our predecessors, and I think that it's a great program, but it had not had the opportunity to jumpstart under the previous administration. And so right now, obviously, you know that Mayor Lightfoot and I, as the city treasurer, we took office on May 20th. And so within these past 4 months, I've really been focusing on, as the chairman of the board, trying to make certain that we get this Catalyst Fund moving. Now, I can feel comfortable in speaking for Mayor Lightfoot because it's actually in print that she stated that she is committed to moving this Catalyst Fund forward. I appreciate that. I look forward to working with her on the Catalyst Fund as chairman of the board. And so what I have done thus far is provided a list of names for recommendations for the board of directors to her. You may have read that in the paper where we believe that there will be a great opportunity to really get started with this Catalyst Fund by choosing our board of directors, making certain that we have the board in place. And so the mayor's team and my team will be meeting very soon to actually talk about those recommendations. And then also we are going to be looking at and reviewing to see if any changes are needed, or are we going to keep everything as is for the current ordinance that sits for the Catalyst Fund. And then in addition to that, I just had a meeting with some business owners really trying to help figure out exactly what direction we're going to go to make certain that we are using the Catalyst Fund at its intent and also providing the best bang for our buck to make certain that we are using this $100 million in a responsible and appropriate manner.
But do we have the $100 million?
Well, currently the fund does have a little under about $75 million. And by December 2019, per the ordinance, we should have $100 million.
And we get the board going and everything like that, and then we can see where this program takes us.
What did you say, Rick?
I said, then we get the board put together, and then we see where this program can take us.
Yes, and again, it's a win-win for our city because we get to help small businesses while making a return on our investment.
We're speaking with City Treasurer Melissa Conyers-Irvin. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone is Melissa Conyers-Irvin. She is the Chicago City Treasurer. And Madam Treasurer, I know you have coming up a Women's Small Business Expo, and that's on Saturday, November 16th at UIC's Doran Forum at 725 West Roosevelt Road. Tell me about this event. Tell me what your goals are for this event.
Yes, and talking about the Catalyst Fund, how we can help small businesses, one thing that I committed to doing as City Treasurer of Chicago is making certain that we are leveraging taxpayers' dollars, and it's time that taxpayers' dollars work for them. And so we want to help promote small businesses. You know, I was talking to, I recall one of the small business owners that we met with this past Friday was telling us about how they have a current brick and mortar, but they need to expand it, and how when they think about the loans that they have applied for, how the interest rates can be so high that it's kind of almost setting themselves up to go out of business. And that was really disheartening, and I thought about how the Catalyst Fund can help businesses like them. You know, Rick, there's hundreds and thousands of small business owners and those that desire to be small business owners that can be very successful if they just had a little help, which we know the Catalyst Fund can help with. But that leads us to the Women's Small Business Expo on Saturday, November 16th at the UIC Doran Forum. You know, Rick, where I come from, we used to call it just UIC Forum, but
right.
Now it is UIC Doran Forum.
Naming rights, naming rights.
Just naming rights, but it's the same place, the UIC Doran Forum, 725 West Roosevelt, and that is from 9 a.m. until 3 p.m. It was very important for me as City Treasurer, a young lady born in Inglewood, raised on the west side of Chicago, that we had an expo that was accessible to people. I didn't want to have it downtown where people couldn't get to it or wasn't able to pay for parking. And so we're going to have it at UIC Doran Forum on Saturday, November 16th. Everything is free. Registration is free. Parking is free. We don't want any barriers. And UIC Doran Forum, as you know, Rick, is a central location in Chicago. Regardless as to what side of town you live on, UIC Doran Forum at 725 West Roosevelt is easy to get to. So at this expo, and by the way, men always ask me, are we able to come? I'm like, of course. We're not going to close the door on the men. But certainly the focus is on women small business and entrepreneurs, and we're going to have hundreds of vendors under one roof where resources will be accessible to those that are small business owners and entrepreneurs and those that desire to be. So, for example, Rick, we're going to have two panels. One panel is going to be moderated by CBS2 investigative reporter Dorothy Tucker, and it will include the vice president of sales of Google, COO of Sun Times, one of our deputy governors of Illinois, someone from Abbeville. And the second panel is going to be talking about procurement, where we're going to have Chicago Department of Aviation. We're going to have the chief procurement officers for the procurement services, as well as Department of Transportation and Highways. And so we're going to make certain that with our vendors, we have someone from the county, the state, the city. There will be governmental agencies from all levels of government, but also we're going to have companies that it is so many vendors that have signed up thus far that we have. But just to give you an example, you know, we have raffle items, which is important, Rick, that everyone register, because when you register, it automatically qualifies you for a raffle, to enter the raffle. Some examples examples of raffle items include people to be able to assist with grant proposals, as well as insurance and financial review for the current or prospective business owner, someone that can help with business tax return preparation, someone that can help with graphic design. We know a lot of businesses are great businesses, but they may need help with branding. These are just examples of what we will have on Saturday, November 16th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. So please, everyone have to come. We want to have this. Spread the word. The UIC Door Forum is a huge location. Everyone should be able to come. Again, join us 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at 725 West Roosevelt. And more information, Rick, can be found on my Facebook page at Shy Treasurer. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We want everyone to register, which takes 1 minute to register. Share it with your family, friends. We're on Facebook.com at Shy Treasurer.
And you can also get information if you email City of Chicago Treasurer Expo at cityofchicago.org.
That is correct.
And again, this is not just for people who are already women who are already our small business owners. It's also for people who want to get into and be entrepreneurs to get into business. So
That's absolutely right.
It sounds like a great event. Again, for more information, quickly.
Facebook at Shy Treasurer. And then also we're on Instagram, Twitter, and we also have a website. But everyone has internet now, so look me up, Chicago Treasurer, Melissa Cunier Zervin. But the easy way is just on Facebook to give me a Shy Treasurer.
That's our city treasurer, Melissa Cunier Zervin. Madam Treasurer, as always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick, and have a good day, everyone.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the WGN Skyline studio, joined by my good friend Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law.
Hey, Rick. How are you?
Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
Well, no, actually, you would have, if it was last week and it was the marathon, you would have missed it. You would not have found a way here.
No, that's true, and not because I was running the marathon.
Now, why not? You seem like you could do a marathon.
You know, I appreciate that. I've never run a marathon.
Really?
No.
Well, it's a marathon.
I thought about it. Thought deeply,
have you really?
Thought deeply about it.
No, you're kidding me.
No, one day, like about 7 years ago.
For a brief moment in time. Right. It was a brief passing moment in time.
It was fleeting.
Yeah, I bet it was.
But in my mind.
Not with your feet.
Yeah, I broke 4 minute mile.
4 minute mile.
Yeah, for 26 miles.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
In your mind.
In my mind.
Okay, so now you've defeated the qualification purposes for talking about anything else for the rest of this hour. No, we're going to talk more substantive issues. And in fact, Jason's been very kind that after we've had these Democratic debates, I think he even did a pre-debate visit here to kind of take a look at where the candidates stand. I want to play just kind of a mash cut here of some of the, I won't say highlights, some of the rhetoric at the debate. I'm not sure there were any highlights.
There were highlights.
Well, let's, okay.
Yeah,
well,
all right. On the other side.
I know, but
right?
as a friend of mine told me, he understands that the Republican National Committee now is willing to fund every Democratic debate, they have to have one every week because of the success that the Democrats are doing to
themselves.
That's
payback for 2016.
No kidding. No
and,
kidding.
And all of their debates.
Indeed, indeed. But I want to start here. This is kind of a bit of highs and perhaps lows from the last debate.
And I'm sorry, Elizabeth, but you have not said that. And I think we owe it to the American people to tell them where we're going to send the invoice.
I was surprised to hear that you did not agree with me that on this subject of what should be the rules around corporate responsibility for these big tech companies, when I called on Twitter to suspend Donald Trump's account, that you did not agree.
Senator Warren said we can't be running any vague campaigns. We got to level with people. got to level with people and tell them exactly what we're going to do, how we're going to get it done, and if you can get it done.
But I want to give a reality check here to Elizabeth, because no one on this stage wants to protect billionaires. Not even the billionaire wants to protect billionaires.
Make it clear that they're not going anywhere and have them protect it and work my way back toward what, in fact, needs to be done, protecting those Kurds. They lost their lives. This is shameful, shameful what this man has done.
The slaughter of the Kurds being done by Turkey is yet another negative consequence of the regime change war that we've been waging in Syria. Donald Trump has the blood of the Kurds on his hand.
When we think our only choices are between endless war or total isolation, the consequence is the disappearance of U.S. leadership from the world stage, Senator, and that makes this entire world a more dangerous place.
What does the president do? He says, I believe Vladimir Putin. I believe Vladimir Putin. I don't believe our intelligence
committee.
You're
suggesting I'm Vladimir Putin.
No, I'm not.
Women have been given the responsibility to perpetuate the human species. Our bodies were created to do that. And it does not give any other person the right to tell a woman what to do with that body. It is her body. It is her right. It is her decision.
We codify Roe v. Wade. The public is already there. Things have changed.
That's right. When I proposed reforming the Supreme Court, some folks said that was too bold to even contemplate. Now, I'm not talking about packing the court just with people who agree with me, although I certainly will appoint people who share my values. For example, the idea that women's reproductive freedom is an American right.
In my judgment, Trump is the most corrupt president in the history of this country.
This president, and I agree with Bernie, Senator Sanders, is the most corrupt president in modern history, and I think all of our history.
Our framers imagined this moment, a moment where we would have a corrupt president. And our framers then rightly designed our system of democracy to say there will be checks and balances. This is one of those moments.
And we'll close there with Kamala Harris. I have to say, I didn't find much in this other than maybe the overall kind of theme of the attacks on Elizabeth Warren as kind of an acknowledgement that now she has perhaps even and has in some polls superseded Joe Biden. And the attacks came on her, as you heard at the beginning. Biden was not so much the subject of the attack, and I wonder if that represents kind of a diminishing viewpoint that his standing in the polls has diminished, that he's no longer the candidate, the front runner that the others are trying to go after.
Well, the rule of thumb is always you want to try to put an arrow in somebody whose balloon is rising, and that's definitely, I mean, from a tactical standpoint, in terms of debate preparation, and that certainly has been Warren, and Biden has been slipping back. I mean, if you look at, there was a poll a couple of weeks ago, the CNN, or the CBS USA Today poll that had a three-way tie in first place in Iowa, Sanders, Warren, and Biden. This week, there was the Emerson poll that had Biden knotted up with Warren in Iowa, with Buttigieg third and Sanders kind of floating back to fourth. So I think that's reflective in what happened the other night. I would depart, though. I think the first hour of the debate was illustrative in terms of how the candidates see each other, but also substantively. I think it was a good debate, once again, often being centered on the healthcare issue, which healthcare plan is going to work, which writ large healthcare system is going to be better. We're going to see more of that. I thought once we got beyond the first hour, the candidates had spent a lot of time and their ammunition at that point. And I thought the second hour was borderline incomprehensible from a viewer perspective. And the third hour was too, although strangely, it was the last half hour where I thought Joe Biden was actually the most effective.
The point where nobody's watching.
Yes, but he was as vigorous as he had been, which perhaps speaks well to his overall vigor, you know, into the 90th minute of the debate. But he and Warren and Sanders were going back and forth at the end once again about whose plans made sense on healthcare. It sort of circled back to that. And I thought that Biden was strangely effective at the end because he was less rhetorical. He simply was just pointing out what the cost was and using, I would argue, a common sense pocketbook approach. You just have to figure out how to pay for it and tell us how to pay for it. Now, there may be answers to that. There are answers to that, I suspect. But I thought in terms of framing the issue, that was about as effective as he was throughout the evening. So I guess I would say first hour, informative and combative in a positive way. Second hour, a wash. Third hour, vaguely helpful to voters.
We're speaking with Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. And have a text message saying we haven't heard a question from Ron yet today.
What should we do about that?
I think we should probably ask Ron. Welcome to the show. What's your question, Ron?
No, good morning, Rick. My question to your guest. The president has pretty much indicated he's going to run on what's perceived as a strong economy, which is typically a good position for a sitting president. What will be the main issue that the Democrats can galvanize behind? I still think that it's health care, but could it possibly be something that's going on in the Middle East? Or, you know, that's it. But that's the main question. What can they get to galvanize the voters behind? Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Well, Ron, I suppose, first of all, you're right about health care. And if we look at the 2018 midterms, that was a major issue for Democrats to run on there. Not simply what kind of health care plan they're proposing, but rather what the Republicans are proposing about the health care that currently exists, pre-existing conditions and the like. So that is still, if you look at polls around the country, that's still an issue that galvanizes people and is important. But the economy comes first in most polls. And so it's going to be an argument about what kind of economy we actually have and what kind of economy we're going to have going forward. So it's not so much what's happening in the economy based on certain measures, it's who's it working for. And that's where you're going to have arguments about who's gotten the bulk of the tax cuts, who's gotten the relief, who's carrying the burdens, what's happening.
Income inequality.
I think those issues will be primary issues. On the foreign policy stuff, I think that'll merge into much larger arguments about what's happening to America on the world stage and what America looks like on the world stage. And so that's where events this week, I think, tie into those themes as well.
But where does that fall as far as a voter concern?
I think lower. It's one of those things that seems more important when there's if there's an imminent crisis, right? So arguments about making America less safe, I think people get that intellectually. You know, if they're told, look, if we abandon this area in northern Syria, ISIS comes back in, that makes America less safe. People understand that, I think, intellectually, but viscerally and emotionally, that doesn't resonate quite as strongly unless there is an attack.
So what wins out, the commitment to, as Trump says, to remove troops from Syria? But
well, I think a way to understand most of what Donald Trump does is through the prism of the 7 to 9 million voters who voted for Barack Obama and also voted for Donald Trump. And I think for those voters, the 7 to 9 million voters estimated across the country who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump in 2016, important issues are issues involving trade, immigration, removing America from foreign conflicts, because those are people who don't deserve our help as much as our own people deserve our help. This would be kind of the worldview. And if you think about every issue that Trump has tried to own in some way over the past couple of years, trade and tariffs, immigration and the wall, and quote unquote, removing our troops from foreign conflicts, of course, these troops are not being removed from abroad. They're actually being moved to Western Iraq. I think those actions are taken with purely political purposes in mind, so that you can easily then go back in 2020 and run based on all of those principles. High tariffs supposedly are better for American industries. That would be the argument. It's certainly an argument that would be made to people who reside within the communities where a lot of these industries once were stronger. Immigration, you know, we build the wall, and again, we preserve American jobs, so the argument would go. So to me, these are a constellation of policies that are built around an electoral strategy. And that strategy is to continue to win those voters, because those are the voters that guarantee you, at least in theory, the 11,000 additional votes you needed to win Michigan last time around, the 23,000 votes you needed to win Wisconsin, the 44,000 votes you needed to win Pennsylvania. And he's aware of that because in each of those states, in Wisconsin, despite what happened in 2016 and 2018, Tony Evers was elected governor by about 0.4%. In Michigan, the Democrats flipped two House seats in 2018. In Pennsylvania, the Democrats flipped four House seats. These states are very much still in play. So each of those issues becomes wedge issues that are crucial for winning in 2020.
But they're very close on the margins, though.
Close on the margins, and that's the point, right? We got these close margins in 2016. We've got Democrats striking back in 2018. These things are very much in flux and in play for 2020, these states.
Going back to the debate stage, are we? Do you think we're down to like four candidates? As far as, you know, I kind of look at Biden and Pete Buttigieg as kind of the more moderate part of the Democrats, and then I look at Warren and Bernie as the more progressive side. Is it too much to say where the field is that limited right now?
I think
out of 19 correct. Candidates.
I think you're correct. If we look back at, for example, 2008, in particular fall of 2007, at this point in 2007, the top three were the top three. You had Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards. Now, their order would change around between this period in 2007 and all the way through South Carolina in that primary cycle. But those top three were set. This time around, you've got more or less this top three of Sanders and Warren and Biden. But as I said, even in the polling as near as a week ago, Buttigieg had moved up to fourth, and he was at 14%, only 9 points behind the other three.
Let's talk more about Pete Buttigieg when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. This is your Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Here in the WGN Skyline studio with my good friend Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Just wanted to play a couple of cuts on Friday. Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, was on the Southwest side at a meet and greet where he was endorsing Marie Newman, who's the primary challenger to Congressman Dan Lipinski, doing a meet and greet, taking lots of selfies. Had a chance to try to ask him a question, but he interrupted me.
You come across in the debates as kind of a unifier.
You have a great radio voice.
I actually do radio.
I was about to say.
I do radio on Sunday. You're always welcome on my show. Yeah,
I would love to do that. Like, you're not a print journalist. You're a radio voice.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I am actually a print journalist, too. And but I'm going to hold him up on this, that he said he would do the show. But I finally got a chance to ask the question.
You come across on the stage as kind of a unifier and don't adopt the Donald Trump lines and that kind of thing. Is that enough to create a great differentiation or pitch to voters?
Look, I think people are going to look at the totality of who I am. I'm a guy that rose in a tough inner city, literally a documentary about me called Street Fight, about how I fought my way to transform a city, how in Washington, in the midst of broken D.C., got big bills done, like the criminal justice reform bill. So I think when people see who I am, but I've always told people, whether it's in Washington or in Newark, that we need to create uncommon coalitions to create uncommon results. We can't rip ourselves apart as a country. When I played football, I knew we were going to score a touchdown when I heard the defensive huddle arguing amongst themselves. I'd be like, we're going to score. Well, we have a global competition going on, and our team can't be ripping itself and tearing itself down. We did big things in this country, from going to the moon to beating the Nazis, when we pulled together, created new American coalitions. If we're going to beat climate change, if we're going to transform our country to be a nation where healthcare is a right for all, these take bigger mobilizations than partisan mobilizations. And so my running, I caution Democrats, we cannot define ourselves by what we're against. We need to start talking about what we're for. We can't even define ourselves in the partisan terms that we're to beat Republicans. No, it's just a moral moment that requires us to unite Americans in common cause and common purpose so that we can deal with the big justice issues that we're facing and seize the opportunity in the 21st century.
He's certainly a senator.
He's definitely a senator. I think he was simply stunned by the power of your radio voice. And it sent him reeling, where he could not, he just couldn't answer the question succinctly.
Well, as a good friend of mine said, at least he didn't say he had a face for radio. And I said, well, he is a politician after all.
He's been a good performer in the debates, but he sounded a lot of those notes that you're talking about there. And the same thing kind of happened, right? We sort of listened to the answer. It seemed moderately compelling, but it didn't seem very pointy in the sense that it jumped out. And that's been him in a lot of these settings. That's why a lot of people think, well, he's really running for vice president. That's really what he's
right,
doing.
Right, or it's like a resume kind of thing, is you know, for down the road.
Maybe, but here's something else to think about. In that poll that I referenced earlier, which was the CBS USA Today poll from about a week ago, which in political life can seem like a year ago, when they asked Iowa voters in that poll what was important to them about a candidate running for president, in the Democratic primary voters, 97% of them said a candidate that can unify people. We think of the Democratic electorate as being fed up, angry, possessing visceral outrage. And it's true, but if you ask them, they will at least say, we want somebody that will unify. He's making somewhat of a bet on that. So is Buttigieg.
Right.
All of the themes that Buttigieg is striking in his opening statements, to the extent there are any in these debates, and if you listen to his performance on Tuesday night, was kind of funneling up all of these answers to the idea of, we have to be able to resume the country as we know it in a unified way after Trump is gone.
So although you know, in some respects he's trying to have it both ways, because he's like, well, people talk about returning to normal. There is no normal anymore.
But where he's departing from somebody like Biden, for example, is that Biden is saying Trump is the problem. Buttigieg is saying Trump is a symptom of the problem, which is what Warren is saying, too. And this is the other point that I think is really important about this primary. Before the break, Rick, you asked about, you know, four candidates, two who are more moderate at this point, Biden and Buttigieg, two who are more progressive, Warren and Sanders. I think broadly stated, that's true. But if you dig a little deeper into the numbers, you see some interesting things. You see, for example, in Iowa, if you average out polls over the past couple of months, Elizabeth Warren leads in among progressives. She gets about 37%, but she's also second among those who classify themselves in the Democratic primary as moderate or conservative Democrats. She gets 20% of the vote. She's not fourth or fifth or sixth.
Right.
She's second among those voters.
She's a second choice. Right?
And on the flip side, Pete Buttigieg, if you look at the Emerson poll that came out this week, he is pulling 16% of the voters who voted for Bernie Sanders in 2016, 16%. Bernie Sanders is only pulling 19% of those voters. He only has 3% more of the people who voted for him in 2016 than the so-called moderate Buttigieg. So I think it's much more fluid in Iowa as between what we perceive from the outside as these two lanes of progressive and moderate. I think Democratic primary voters, yes, largely fall along those lines. If you go onto Twitter, they definitely fall along those lines. But I think if you go out to Democrats as a whole, it's much more nuanced than that in terms of who they're looking for.
But as part of that, perhaps Iowa itself, because, I mean, it's not what I would wildly describe as a progressive state, among a progressive Democrat.
Okay, but then you go to the early map and the states that are in play. Iowa, is New Hampshire that liberal of a state? Probably not. If you look at South Carolina, African-American voters who are lined up at this point, they're not lined up with the most progressive candidate, Warren or Sanders.
Biden.
They're lined up with Biden. He's more of the moderate candidate. Maybe Nevada, although it's such a strong union state, it's hard to know exactly which way that would cut also. So if you look at the early states that give oxygen to campaigns, if you do well there, it seems much more fluid to me in terms of where these candidates are actually going and where they're pulling support from.
Obviously, again, we touch on this, a lot of attention given to the healthcare issue. And, I mean, Warren's inability to say whether the middle class would be taxed, Bernie Sanders has already acknowledged that they would be under his plan. But, you know, kind of also coming to that fine line about Medicare for all and private insurance. And I think we know where the lines are on who is what. So why do we have to keep revisiting this issue over again?
I think it's useful to revisit it. I know those of us who watch these debates regularly think, oh, we've covered this already, but not everybody watches every single debate. And I actually think the debate has gotten more refined as we've gone along. I think the candidates...
Well, on healthcare, yes.
On that issue, I think Klobuchar, who had a very good night on Tuesday night, and Buttigieg were more pointed in their critique, which pointed a sharper light on the issues of not only how to pay for it, but what the cost is going to be. And I think what Klobuchar and Buttigieg did on Tuesday night was they bridged a problem that John Delaney, the late, great John Delaney, we might say, had earlier on when he had made many of the same complaints to Warren and had really been smacked down very effectively by Warren. And it's always difficult, I think, when you are proposing something that seems more moderate to seem bold.
Right.
And Delaney looked very much timid,
right,
in that exchange. And I think what the more moderates did the other night was they were just more vigorous in the critique, and that made it a much sharper contrast, but also didn't make it sound like what they were for was more timid. Now, the flip side is also true. Warren is a very effective debater. She was under siege all the time on Tuesday night and more or less held in there pretty well. She's going to have similar critiques to the so-called public option. I mean, what does a world with the public option actually look like? Are insurance companies just going to wither away? Because that is what Buttigieg is arguing, that eventually, he calls it a glide path to Medicare for all, is by having the public option. Well, what does that process actually look like? Do private insurance companies simply wither away? Do they charge higher premiums to the people who decide they're going to stay on private health insurance? I don't think we know the answers to that. And I'm not taking a position on that here
right
today. What I am saying, though, is as a matter of debate, I think there's a further debate to have through rhetorical tactics, using language to paint a picture of what the future is going to look like. And what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And now I think Bernie and Warren have a chance to come back and lodge similar complaints against Pete, Biden, and Amy Klobuchar.
We're speaking with Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the WGN Skyline studio by Jason DeSanto, my good friend, senior lecturer at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. We were talking about the Democratic debates, but I want to switch subjects here in just the final few minutes we have. The death of Elijah Cummings, head of the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, and quite a pillar in the House. And other than the president's condolence message, I do think that the condolence messages of a number of House Republicans were indeed came from the heart.
I think he was a very respected member of the body and somebody who served with distinction and also with passion for the people that he represented. You can't ask for much more than that.
What does this do about impeachment, since oversight was one of the three committees that is part of the impeachment inquiry of Donald Trump?
I think there's a little bit of a question about who's going to fill the spot, and that arguably could slow things down, but a lot of the activity has moved away from the oversight committee also.
Well, it's Adam Schiff and House Intelligence Committee.
Yep. And so it shouldn't slow anything down. I doubt that it will. But we are starting to get into the question of what is the timetable here. And I know Pelosi's gotten a lot of questions about that. And the speaker has said the timetable is governed by the Constitution, not by politics. We're not concerned about going into 2020. We're concerned about making sure this is done correctly. I think broadly stated, that's true. But I think there are some questions about what it's going to look like if we have the middle of an impeachment inquiry into the early part of next year, which I think at this point is likely to be the timetable.
Just back to Elijah Cummings, I'm almost of the feeling that he's not going to get the due attention that he's deserved because we're in this atmosphere of impeachment.
Yes and no. I mean, Rick, I did see some people saying that one of the last things he did, he was sick for a while, was he signed subpoenas to be issued related to the investigation. So as it is in so many things, after somebody passes, the question is, what do their life mean? What do they stand for? That's really what a eulogy is about from a speech perspective. And so people come to represent something. They come to stand for something. And I think the people who are friends of his, people who were allies of his, people who really respected him, will come to make the argument that this is proceeding and making sure that no one is above the law is something that he believed in. And so we're doing something that's consistent with what he lived for and what he thought was most important. So I think in that way, he can be honored through their actions, and they'll say as much.
Do you believe impeachment should roll into 2020 and be guided by the Constitution, as Pelosi says, or the feeling that people want some action at least by Thanksgiving time?
Impeachment is a funny animal.
Isn't it?
It's a legal concept.
It's a camel. It's designed by committee.
It is a multi-humped creature, yes. I think what we really have here is we have something which is within the Constitution but has a clearly political dimension to it, because you have public representatives who are doing the voting, you have people in the Senate who are going to decide whether or not to convict, so it's a hybrid. Whether or not it is something that is genuine, I think Pelosi is correct that it should be governed by whatever it is that is uncovered and the ability to ventilate those issues. And when you have people marching down from the State Department against the wishes of the administration to testify about the concerns that they had, that is the process, in my view, working as it should. Facts are being adduced, they are being assembled, and from that there will be a set of charges. That said, I think Schiff has been very clear with the Democratic Conference that to some extent the best evidence is the evidence that's the most public, which is the transcript of the call that Trump had with the Ukrainians. So what we have here
is... Not to mention Mick Mulvaney speaking in the White House press room.
Yeah. So you kind of have this situation where what's public is very damaging, but you have all these other people who've dedicated their lives to foreign service coming forward and saying, this is not the way foreign policy is to be conducted. And we definitely were told to work through Rudy Giuliani, who is not an employee of the United States government, let alone the State Department.
What about as far as Republican complaints about this? These interviews are being done behind closed doors, and they want transparency. Let alone they want a floor vote to authorize.
Yeah, I mean they have people there. There is some reticence to take a vote on the Democratic side to have a full inquiry, because the Speaker doesn't want to put into jeopardy people who are in districts where that might be difficult for them to take the vote. If you look at the polling among the public is now over 50%, about 52%, if you average all the polls, I think, saying that the inquiry is well-founded. A little less than 50, if you average the polls on whether Trump should be removed. Those numbers are about even, 49-48 on the inquiry in swing districts. So it's a much closer proposition. She wants to protect those people. But you could also say the opposite, that you would put Republicans on the spot to have to take a vote on whether or not there should be an inquiry. Politically, I think that would be useful at this point.
That's Jason DeSanto, my good friend, senior lecturer at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Jason, as always, thank you. And I suppose we'll be talking again after the next Democratic debate.
Thanks, Rick. Enjoyed it.